Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren, and we're coming to you from the west coast of Sweden. We have a new program available every Thursday and Sunday. And remember that you can always backtrack and tune into any of our previous shows by simply accessing our radio archive at redicecreations.com. This is the third Thursday of August, and we are back to our normal routine with our regular guest Michael Tesarion, who joins us today for his monthly spot. If you're new to the work of Michael Tesarion, there are a few websites that you need to take a look at right away. MichaelTesarion.com, the main website, and from there you'll find links to Terroscopes.com, OriginsandOracles.com, and also, of course, IrishOriginsOfCivilization.com. Last time Michael was with us, we talked about the west to east movement of civilization, Ireland and the British Isles, that was a part of Atlantis. We also talked about the existence of land bridges that made this west to east movement possible, and the cataclysms that have laid some of this evidence underwater and also have shaped our continents to their current form. And we also talked about the importance of the word return. Very interesting, important, and controversial material. And today we are going to continue with these points in our backs and begin to talk about the Celts, with focus on, among other things, the term itself. Where does Celt or Celtic come from, and who's responsible for this name or term? And looking forward to talking more with Michael about this and much more. So let's welcome back Michael to the program, and at the same time open the show with this quote here. There is no evidence in the British Isles to suggest that a population group of any size migrated from the continent in the first millennium BC. And this is from Sir Barrington Windsor Cunliffe, from a book called Iron Age Britain. So tell us about that quote, Michael.
Well, that's a very important quote, and it goes to the heart of my particular, you know, slant. Remember last time on the show we were talking about, you know, I'd gone out into the field and looked very closely at the megaliths and tried to work out, you know. It was at that time that I started to realize that what we were being told by these tour guides and also by most of the books that we were picking up, that, you know, it just wasn't accurate. It wasn't, we weren't being told the truth. Yeah. About Ireland, you know, and about... And it takes a while, you see, to actually find out where the biggest lies are. And by the way, I think I did make a mistake, a slip of the tongue. In the previous show, I mentioned that when I was out studying the megaliths in Ireland, it was about 1995 or 1990s. That's actually a slip of the tongue. It was a mistake. It's actually the 1980s.
Oh, really?
1985, so just to clear that up.
Okay, yeah, so that's way longer then.
Well, remember I was saying that I got involved with Jim Fitzpatrick's work about 1979?
Mm, yeah.
And then it went from no interest at all to sort of a, you know, a great question mark, you know, above my head, going, there is such a thing as Irish culture, more than, you know, what you find in the streets of Belfast.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that sort of happened in 1979, 80. By 81, late 81, it had become a very strong interest at that point. And I was in America, and America having a lot more bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot more access. It's unbelievable. The libraries were so well stocked. You know, it was just like coming from night to day, because over in America, they don't have any, you know, the Catholic Protestant, you know, conflict or anything like that. So,
yeah.
You know, the libraries were stocked. There was a lot of great books.
Mm.
It was very easy to start getting books on my own country. And that's when, you know, I really started my studies. And it was about that time that I started to have a question myself about this term Celtic, whether it was even, you know, correct or not, because it's used constantly to describe the Irish, and more importantly, it's used constantly to describe the very early Irish people, you see, and even on television shows, Discovery Channel shows, you know, BBC, I mean, pretty, you know, high-budget movies.
Sure.
And documentaries still use this term, and I refuse to use that term in my work, you know, and as I said, back in 1982, I started to have a real problem with it, you know, and then around 19, I think it was 85, then I had been back in Ireland, and that's when I actually did physically go into the field and start, you know, touring around Ireland and looking at some of these megaliths, some of the ones that, of course, are obvious and some of them are not obvious.
Yeah.
And, of course, the biggest shocker of all, and I bet you this has happened to lots of people, is the discovery that not only are most of these stone circles and megalithic sites astronomically aligned,
yeah,
they still are.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, nothing's changed. You can go, you know, you can go and see them. You can study them, you can observe them in relationship to the stars. It's just fantastic. You know, there's these great earthwork zodiacs over in England.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just unbelievable, you know, and there's no parallels to these things anywhere else in the world. You may have great pyramids in Egypt, but you don't have earthwork zodiacs and things like that, you know.
Yeah.
And the same patterns are in Egypt, the same patterns of the great monuments not only being marvels of construction, but they're also aligned to the various constellations. And this shows you that there's a kindredness because, okay, a lot of the evidence has been covered up. But when you find that Stonehenge in England is geomantically and geometrically aligned to the Great Pyramid, when you find that the Great Pyramid is aligned to the north, south, east, west axis, you see, and that some of the stones of other stone circles in Ireland, I mean, look, if the guys in Las Vegas who built that pyramid for that casino can align that Black Pyramid with the Pyramid of Giza, that's done today. It's officially known that they did that.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow, cool.
Oh, absolutely. Sun City, you name it, Memphis, Tennessee.
Yeah.
You know, these places are not just named after the places on the Nile. They're actually situated on ley lines and dragon lines, and it's no different than the Sphinx that's sitting, that hideous Sphinx that's sitting in Las Vegas for the edification of all the tourists who go there. And this enormous Black Pyramid there, you know, are physically aligned by the architects and the civic designers to the pyramid itself.
Wow, really?
It's like people who've tracked that, we don't want to get into the whole byway of this, but, you know, people who know my work know that I emphasize again and again this important aspect of the geometry and the sacred geometry of the cities and the layouts of the cities. Other people have covered this subject, people like Graham Hancock and others, you see, but they can't explain it. Well, you can explain it when you realize that every single government body and every Judeo-Christian organization, including the Vatican at Rome, is based on Egyptian Atenism, then you can understand it, because these people are carrying on a tradition. There's a reason why there's 13 obelisks in Rome and only 5 in Egypt.
That's right. Wow.
And there's only 21 or so, you know, obelisks left in the world.
Mm.
But the vast majority of those are in Western countries like Paris, Rome, and New York, I mean, not New York, but London, Washington,
sure.
And there's only a handful in Egypt. Doesn't that tell us something?
Yeah.
Why would a Bourbon monarch, you see, or a Windsor, or a Tudor, you see, or, you know, the top popes who are meant to be anti-pagan, okay, get this, anti-pagan, but they got 13 obelisks from Egypt in the city of Rome. What happened? Those obelisks just happened to find their way there, you know, by accident or something.
Yeah, that's right. And those who don't have their own, gotten their own from Egypt, they're more than happy to construct their own versions of it anyway, so.
Well, they do, because exactly, they've constructed so many. I mean, that's an entire subject in itself. But the very fact that these pyramids are aligned, and what I have discovered in the field of Ireland, is that there are alignments that connect the famous megaliths of Ireland and England and Wales and Scotland not only to the same constellations that were worshipped in Egypt, that were of importance in Egypt, like the Pleiades and the Orion, you see, and Sirius. There's no difference. There's no difference. So that tells you that there's one stellar cult operating here. But in the days before laymen were able to buy telescopes, in the day before laymen, you know, were able to read books and study this stuff, the upper class, you know, the dignitaries and the nobles of the world, they were the only ones who knew this stuff.
Yeah.
It was only the Knights Templar families, you see, who had kept the maps and records of the ley lines and the dragon paths. It was only the Templar families who knew about these famous things called the fault lines, for instance, upon which many stately homes and churches and monasteries are built on all throughout the world, the famous salt lines. People go to the appendices section online, they can learn about that. There's, you know, it was only these secret societies who preserved the fact of the Druids, the Druidic teachings, and about these various constellations and what they meant. And they didn't want you to know about it, so they defaced the standing stones. They chipped off, just like exactly the same way in Egypt. They chipped off the, you know, they actually took away the stones is what they did. They removed the stones. You know, anybody who's, you know, after they listen to this interview, goes to Newgrange, just go and ask the tour guide, those imbeciles there, hey, these rocks, all these stones that make the foundation of Newgrange, are these where you found them? Are these stones exactly in the same position as when, you know, the archaeologists and the renovators went in here? And they will lie to you and say, oh, yes, yes, everything is, you know, I mean, stuff is being cleaned up and so on and so forth. But everything you see is, you know, basically the way it was when we discovered it. That is a total lie. These places in Newgrange have been radically changed and modified. The stones that make the foundation of the famous Newgrange, people come onto my website to see photographs of this incredible place. It's older than the pyramids. These stones, which are huge, huge, gigantic, tons and tons and tons of weight, were turned around and put face in so that tourists, travelers, students, you see, researchers, couldn't see the markings that were on these stones, because these markings were highly astrological. Featured luminaries, suns and moons. They featured runes. They featured, you see, these markings, cup markings that showed that there was links between the ancient Sumerians and the Phoenicians. The same thing as Barry Fell discovered in America.
Yeah.
And you know what they told him when he discovered Celtic? I'm using the word Celtic, but I really mean the Irish petroglyphs. He found runes. He found Irish ogham.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
You know what he was told? By the top authorities, the Smithsonian, all the people who came out from his own university and from every other major government-funded think tank to study his work, they said, oh, come on, Barry, don't you realize that this was all designed by Indians who were high on hallucinogenic drugs? I mean, come on, do us a favor. This is not Irish ogham. This is a bunch of doodles made by those stupid Indians who were all high. Okay, so forget it. We know all about that. But he looked at them as if they were talking nonsense. The man had discovered the evidence that the Indians themselves say came from, they would say, the east, of course, meaning the our west.
Yeah, yeah.
He's sitting there discovering. He discovers that the Indians have said that the mound, the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of mounds, there's thousands of them.
Yeah.
These mound buildings and all these megalithic ruins dating from so far back, they found skeletons that predate, you know, they found Indo-European skeletons in America.
That's
just
right.
In exactly the same way as they found Inca skeletons in Norway.
In Norway, yeah, that's right. Wow.
You know, do me a favor. They found all these Western corpses, skeletons, showing that America was, you know, as those land bridges again.
Yeah.
But the fact is, they turn around to Mr. Fell, Barry Fell, one of the greatest researchers in our world, and say, oh, there's no Irish connection. That's a bunch of Indians who are on hallucinogenics.
Yeah.
He points out to them that the Algonquin language is basically a variation of Gaelic.
Yeah.
He basically points out that the chiefs of many of the tribes of North Carolina and Virginia have a tradition in which they say that Irish shaman taught them their language.
Yeah, exactly. Isn't that
amazing?
And
there's only two cases in the whole of America in which the American Indian language was not based on Gaelic. And these guys in America, who we understand now, you see, who these people are, these are the deceivers.
Yeah.
But they cannot deceive you if you go and look at the evidence of your own eyes. And in 1985, without knowing a thing about any of this stuff, without really wanting to do anything more than a hobby, I started to realize that this is just incomprehensible. That how can a bunch of skin-wearing, bone-chucking, bone-frozen people, like we're told existed in, you see, England, Ireland, Scandinavia, primitive, backward, you know, fishermen, the best, you know, it would be a miracle if these people could get together a couple of nets to do some fishing, we're told, could be then designing these megalithic sites and aligning them to the constellations.
Yeah.
Not possible.
So there's something.
So from there on, you see, I started to then, in my mind, what I do is I start to note all these inconsistencies.
Yeah.
All the knowledge that I have is based on not direct, you know, discovery as deconstructive work of discovering what has been said, but which doesn't add up. It's more like a detective, you know?
Yeah, laying the puzzle, you know?
Yeah, you know, and it's just like you can go around and you can see tiny inconsistencies. And to me, these inconsistencies, you know, are huge. They, for some reason, my mind really notices them.
Yeah.
And it showed me then that some sort of crime had been committed, that this wasn't just, you know, just like we said about the positioning of churches last time. It started to look like, hang on, how can first of all, how can the Irish people and the English people, you know, not notice this stuff that's right in front of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, how can you live in Somerset, right beside the Somerset Zodiac, and not pay any attention to it? How can you be an Englishman or an Irishman or a Welshman and keep going into these inns and pubs and bars which are named after the constellations?
Mm-hmm.
It's very iconography and symbolism, yeah, right in the names of these places.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the lion and the unicorn, you see?
Mm-hmm.
The black dog, the seven sisters, the seven crowns. How can people be in a sea of symbolism and not notice it?
Well, if they don't know it from the start, you know, any knowledge about the zodiac, for instance, then they don't never going to know it, you know.
Well, that's true, but you see, I'm talking also about the megalithic sites. I mean, those are marvels. These have been on television. You know, people go to,
sure,
picnics at these places.
Sure.
A couple of people, you know, different people go, well, yeah, I wonder how these were made, you know. But see, of course, we have the Christian indoctrination that these were satanic, you know, these people were dark and bloodthirsty,
sure,
and evil,
mm,
you know, and it makes a good photograph, you know, so you can be standing in front of, you know, Stonehenge or something like that. But, you know, there's no, it looks good for the family album.
Sure.
There's no real need to start questioning who and what these people were, and they'll believe any lies that are put in front of them by the establishment.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
about 1985, this radically changed. I didn't have any answers, but I certainly had a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm.
But wait a minute, you know, this is unbelievable. You know, this is the level of sacred geometry.
Yeah.
And then when you go to the next level down, you keep studying, you start to find out that the symbolism is incorporated into a lot of the churches that were standing on top of these ancient sites.
Mm.
The symbolism in the churches, Henrik, was sort of echoing the symbolism of the site itself.
Mm. That's amazing.
Like in the stained glass windows and the numerological designs of the churches,
yeah,
were actually appropriated from the previous site. Now, wait a minute. Building a temple or your own church on top of an ancient site,
mm,
is one thing. And somebody could argue, well, you know, okay, that was bad. It shouldn't have happened. But, you know, it wasn't malicious, really.
Mm.
Yeah, but hang on a minute. How can you then explain that the same symbolism is appearing in a different form, in a Christian way, in a Christian idiom, in the same churches as was encoded into the megalithic sites? Now, that shows knowledge. That shows deliberate appropriation of specific knowledge that was had in ancient days. That's not just a simple matter of, you know...
Sure, and at the same time, a kind of a... that they categorize what has been there previously, meaning that they archive the knowledge maybe in some way also.
Exactly. They have appropriated the knowledge, and they're re-scripting it and doing it in a different way. The building over the site was one phase of what I call colonialization. And, you know, the absorption of the knowledge. This is how you know that certain malignant things have happened. And my brain picked up on that.
Yeah.
Nobody else that I was with or, you know, studying with was that interested. They were just looking at it in a very sort of a shallow way, I believe. You know, they weren't really connecting the dots.
Mm.
I soon realized that we're talking about some sort of crime here.
Mm.
And then part of my background is Eastern, you see. So
in
the East, you know, my Indian ancestors are completely aware of this, of the colonial, of the world colonialization.
Mm.
So how can you go to any Hindu or Brahmin or Dravidian, you see, or any group in the East, any African, any you know, person from Fiji, anyone from anywhere in the East, in fact, anyone from anywhere south of the equator, anybody south of the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, colonialism, you know, we forget that here. We forget, oh, we're living in, you know, England, Ireland, Scandinavia, Germany. We don't remember anything about colonialization. That's like a foreign word to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
We don't realize that colonialization is, you know, a tremendous issue in most of the other so-called third world countries. They know exactly what colonialization means. And what my work is trying to show is that that is now no less a process that happened in England and Ireland and Scandinavia. Colonialization from the Romans and Judeo-Christianity, because there's different kinds of colonialization.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, exactly. There's many levels on it, and it has come in different waves or bursts. And again, we have, as we emphasized last time, also the importance of the return of this. So again, this is waves, wax and wanes, almost back and forth, I guess.
This is one of the things that I, you know, started to really notice is that we can't, in an hour show, we can't get into all the, you know, the unbelievable catalog of lies that was spread, you know. but certainly one of them is that these lands were naked. These lands were pretty much unpopulated until they were reached by European groups.
Mm-hmm.
But what we see, it's like it's like Clint Eastwood with his Magnum, 38 has come along and blown a hole through that lie.
Mm-hmm.
When you analyze the word Celtic, because mm-hmm. when you find out that the word Celtic has no significance, you've got that bullet hole that has just completely shot down this whole east to west movement. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a Michael Tesorian sort of, theory that he's just conjured up. I mean, this is from their own writings, which mm-hmm. I have in my book. I've explained it, that these individuals who created this term, hundreds of years ago, mm-hmm. and then brought it back again in about the 1700s in a sort of a romantic way to conjure this idea of these harp-playing Celtic people, these mm-hmm. goddess worshippers.
Mm-hmm.
You see, none of that is sustainable anymore.
Mm-hmm.
My book shows you a meticulous, understanding.
Mm-hmm.
That the word Celtic is unsubstantiated. It does not really refer to the people of Ireland. And more importantly, why was it used? It's a colonialistic device.
Hmm.
It's exactly the same device as you had in Mexico when the conquistadors from Spain said, okay, you go to Mexico, what language do you hear people speaking? Spanish. Are these people Spanish? No. They're Mexicans. How come they're speaking the language of Spain?
That's right.
There's a term for that. It's called colonialization.
That's
colonization.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, they don't mind, because the mind has been colonized. Colonization is not just a thing that happens geographically.
Yeah.
It happens psychologically.
Oh, yeah.
So you go to the average Mexican, they're not even thinking from the day they're born, I'm speaking the language of Spain.
Yeah.
You go to the Quechua, you go to the Aztecs, and you're dealing with colonialization.
Mm.
The food that these people eat is different than what they ate before. The clothes that they wear has been changed.
That's right.
The religion that they worship has been altered. The language they're speaking. Now, in terms of Ireland, you're talking about genocide? There was a war of Armageddon declared upon the Irish language, Henrik. Colonialization has many forms, you see. It doesn't only colonize physically with armed guards, armed soldiers.
Mm.
There's other kinds of war that are declared. And one of the biggest wars that is declared is on culture.
Mm-hmm.
Because the colonists not only bring their empire, and that's what empire is all about.
Yeah.
They don't only bring their own empire. They suppress the civilizations that they find.
Of course.
Now, the interesting thing about this, though, is that just imagine in your mind, what happens if a colonialistic force like the Roman Empire, throw your mind back and think, if you're the colonizer, but you go to a land in which the people are more civilized than you are.
Mm.
Now, don't think in today's terms, which we think the Irish were less civilized.
Mm.
Throw your mind back that you are a bunch of murderous colonizers who are going to write the history of the world, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We accept that. But at the time that you're going about massacring and colonizing, you keep bumping into people who are infinitely more peace-loving, spiritualized, poetical, and tuned in than you are, meaning more civilized than you. Do you think that you're going to want that, to leave those civilizations in pristine form? Did the white people, the white colonizers leave the Native American Indians and the shaman that they found to be more civilized? Did they leave them there and go, oh, you guys are much more civilized than us? We're going to leave now.
Yeah, exactly. No. They handed them blankets with smallpox on them,
That's it. Hmm. Poisoning, an actual deliberate campaign to not only get in there and find out what kind of rivalries exist between these people that we can exploit.
Hmm.
How can we exploit their national prejudices or whatever? And if they don't founder, because if they all get together, if they put all their, differences aside and they start attacking us, which is what happened in America, that's what happened in Ireland, all the Irish put down their differences, and turned upon the Romans, made it very difficult. Well, then you poison them, you destroy them, you take them over in other ways.
Sure.
And you can also do it ideologically.
Mm.
If you go to you don't even have to go back to ancient history.
Mm.
An average Irish person can tell you what Oliver Cromwell did, how they forced the Catholic people, to convert to Protestantism and to live in a different way, to not go to their churches, to burn down their churches. If you go to, Spanish Jews, in their history, they know that they were forced by the royal dynasties of Spain to convert to Christianity.
Hmm.
A forced colonization of their belief system, right?
Mm, yeah.
Evidence in history. Witches were first forced to convert. As we said, the American Indians. We have, you know, Oliver Cromwell, and we have William the Conqueror, a French guy coming over to England to tell how the English, you know, are not meant to live.
Sure.
Meaning that you had a split there between the Normans and the Saxons, the famous times of Robin Hood. You know, everybody should know that, the famous conflict between the Saxons, who declared themselves English.
Mm.
Of course, the Saxons were German. They had conquered England themselves just a few hundred years before. But there's nothing like a new colonization to make you feel that you're indigenous.
That's right, exactly.
So Saxons, who are already speaking German in England, now become more British, more English than the English, because they've been colonized now by foreigners from the arch side, you see. So waves and waves of colonization also have this problem.
Of course,
but what I really want to focus on is, for people who've got to understand this, is that colonization is not just a thing of India, you see, and Fiji Islands and, you know, the Congo and Kenya, you know, and South America.
Mm.
Colonizations have happened in the West. They are part of the world. And they involve two levels of attack, two forms of violence.
Mm.
They are the physical form, and then there's the suppression of the natural indigenous autochthonous cultures, languages that exist in these places, particularly if those places happen to be more colonized, more civilized.
Mm.
And once you have then suppressed those places, you write the history.
Mm.
And what you say is that all these people were barbaric, pagan, bloodthirsty, and at each other's throats until we came along.
Mm. Yeah.
We put an end to all of that. We civilized these people.
Oh, my God. And it's
happening in Serbia right now. The Serbs have been completely crushed by the might of the West. You know, England is its old allies. Look at the horror, the shame of this.
Oh, yeah.
The old allies, America and Britain, you know?
Yeah.
And the United Nations and NATO bring down the might of their empire on Serbia so that the Serbs are crushed. And now a program of colonialization will happen in Yugoslavia, as it has.
Of course.
Remember I said on one earlier show way back that once you've dealt with the big kahunas, you bring up all those little small potato?
Yeah, those small pieces left on the table, as it were, that you hadn't time or the effort or whatever to extinguish at the time of the big takeover, I guess.
But you always keep the map, you know, it gathers a bit of dust, but you go, we'll take care of them later. Hang on, we got a problem with those guys.
Sure.
But we haven't got the time right now. You see, I believe that the Fabian attack on America has taken up a lot of energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But now that one's pretty much signed, sealed, and delivered, excuse me to my American listeners, but I'm sorry to have to tell you this. But now that that's all in the bag, now they can go, wait a minute, didn't we have a problem over there? What was that old vendetta that we have?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Persia going back to Iraq again, and then Kosovo, and we have a few places left, I guess, on the map that they want to, you know, turn around. We have Iran potentially and Syria next, but who knows, you know.
That's right. And remember, you see, this is what's called neo-colonialism. Let nobody in their wildest dreams, and this is why America has been recolonized, is because of the cultural amnesia, the historical amnesia that people like myself, our work is always to wake people up from this, sense of historical amnesia. America has fallen because of historical amnesia. They forgot who their enemies were. They forgot how the colonialism works.
Mm.
That you don't, you know, okay, just because ships aren't amassing on your shores doesn't mean that the process of colonialization has ceased.
Yeah.
People should never forget that the colonialism is a constant thing. It's happening today. It's just that our, you know, sense of historical amnesia, you know, tends to think that it's something of the past.
Yeah, that's right.
And if we have pseudo-governments today, if we've got United Nations and NATO, we've got to understand that these are the old imperialistic. They haven't changed. Their symbolism shows you that they're basically using exactly the same symbolism as the old Habsburg, you see. You know, if people want to find out where the double-headed eagle of Freemasonry comes from, they've only got to start looking up the Habsburg dynasty on Wikipedia or one of the encyclopedias to find out. I mean, it's not that hard.
Yeah.
You know, and they want to find out where the Atenists are. Well, just look at the word NATO and rearrange the letters, and you'll have a pretty good idea where the Atenists are now.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, that's right.
You know, I mean, it's really in plain sight, Henrik. You know, it's just that people, we're in an age of awakening now.
Yeah.
And so, and we are an educated class of people with a lot more freedom intellectually than our forefathers ever had.
Yeah.
So it's, I always maintain, you see, that's why I'm an optimist in all of these areas, is because when it comes to the conspiracy and these things, it's not that, see, people go, hey, you know, they email me all the time going, man, we're so asleep. People are, you know, what are we going to do to wake people up? It'll help if you realize that nobody is asleep. It's just that they haven't been awakened. When you say, oh, the people of the world are asleep, you're implying that at one point in time, they were awakened to all of this.
Yeah.
Then they fell asleep, and now they need to be reawakened again.
That's right. No one has died
here. That's not true.
Yeah.
This is the only time, the only age, that man can have a chance to awaken to all that was hidden from him forever. There has been no time of mass awakening in the past. So you can't say that people are asleep. They've never been awakened. There's a difference.
Is that
the time of awakening is right now. These radio shows, the internet, you know, the very words, the very work that we put out, the very work that, you know, people are contributing to, is the first time in history that we become aware. That's why I don't want to see a shred of pessimism from any human being. All I want to see is an unbelievable passion and tremendous confidence and utter, you know, what you would call, it's just like when you're opening your Christmas presents, you know, that feeling of just great enthusiasm.
Sure.
When you realize that you are for the first time learning what centuries of your forefathers could never hope to grasp, even if they were able to work a little bit out on their own.
Yeah. So this is, that's amazing. And that it's so, as you said, it's so positive and so such an encouragement because, again, I think a lot of people feel this, heaviness, as it were, of all the, you know, darkness of the information and what actually has been going on. But I totally agree with what you're saying, Michael.
It's so important to understand this, you know, that there's no need. It's, you know, it's like I said before, the subject of history, yep, I agree with you that it's boring, especially when you're dealing with textbooks, you see, and conventional methods of teaching history.
Yeah. Yeah,
but that's not what we're talking about here. I just got an email the other day going, you know, this is all very interesting, this ancient history, you know, what kind of, you know, meaning does it have?
Really?
Well, it's not history for a start. It's finding out how history has been manipulated.
Yeah, exactly.
My work is not about history. It's about empire building. It's about New World Order. It's about how to get aware of the modus operandi of the villains and the, you know, these criminals who are building at this very moment in time the altar of sacrifice upon which the whole world is slowly being put.
Sure, that's right. That's right.
You know, they're erecting the big black pyramid of power. Everyone's living under its shadow. That's who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And you can't understand these people until you understand their motives. It's no good just exposing a liar. You have to expose the lie. You have to expose why they would think of creating such a lie and disseminating it.
Sure, again, and this is not about, as you said previously, Michael, this is not about only thrashing at the branches of the tree of, you know, evil or whatever you want to call it. This is about going to the root, and that takes you back, you know, an awful lot of years, because this is a plan that has been in the works for a long, long time, you know?
Exactly. And you see, if you look up the word colonization in the dictionary, you'll find that it has a secondary meaning. And I find that secondary meaning to be very, very important.
Character.
Word colonization is used as a biological term to represent the colonization of a cell or of a body.
Oh, really?
By a foreign substance.
An alien invasion, almost.
Right. by a bacteria or a virus.
Interesting.
So again, in my mind, that works perfectly to explain how these empires, because remember, there's nothing healthy about an empire. There's nothing healthy about those people who want to build empire. These are the most toxic, sinister, and unhygienic, you see, people amongst us.
Sure.
Who are infected, as I've said so many times before, by, you know, pathology.
Yeah.
And they're only going to be happy when the whole world is suffering from the same disease. As a lot of people are succumbing to this disease.
Yeah.
And so their embarkation to go and colonize different places. And then when they get to these places, be it the Indus Valley settlements of ancient times, you see, or, you know, whatever, you're dealing with highly advanced megalithic people who are inheritors of the knowledge of Atlantis and Lemuria and the ancient fallen continents that are annihilated. And you get there and you realize that these are your old Atlantean rivals from the past. And you realize that they have maintained a tremendous, you know, sanctity. You have to declare war on them, and you're trying to infect them in exactly the same way that a bacteria or a virus infects a healthy cell. And you're trying to raise your own Leviathan, you know, to dominate the minds of the world. And you know that that's not going to happen while these wonderful people with their high wisdom exist. So at any age and at every age, there's a colonization. And as we started the show, that colonization also involves the language. You know, I believe that, like for instance, the Norwegian, Swedish languages are different today. Right now, the people who speak your language, it would be almost hard to understand, just even 50 years ago, the Swedish that was spoken then. Is that right or am I wrong?
In a sense, that's right. I mean, it wouldn't be totally... incoherent in that way, but to a certain degree, especially the writing of the language is you know way different back then than it is today. That's for sure.
And it's the same in England. If you people will know this, if they've gone to school and studied Shakespeare, Shakespeare is written in English. But you ask anybody who sat and tried to read, you know, one of Shakespeare's works or any like Chaucer, was that easy?
No,
it's considered one of the most difficult things to do.
Yeah, that's right.
It's considered a sign of your distinction, in fact, and your educatedness, you know, if you're able to, you know, read Shakespeare and all of this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Well, what my point is look, that's only, 400 or 500 years ago.
That's right, yeah.
So we're talking about massive changes in the language. And these, see, what happened in the context of Ireland is that the British government actually sent out troopers, redcoats, who were highly skilled in orienteering and also in cartography, which is the making of maps. And did you know that they sent them around the country? They sent groups, contingents. There'd usually be like three or four of them. There'd be a captain, you see, and two or three other guys sent out from these cartography divisions. And their job was to go around every town, you know, and make their maps of Ireland. But they were told to alter and transmogrify the terms.
Really?
Yeah. You did not write down what you saw. Or, you know, of course, they didn't have street signs in those days anyway, but
sure.
If somebody came to a village, if these redcoats came to a village, and they said to the village, what's the name of this place then, love, you know? And they go, well, this is, you know, this is Green Hill. I'll give you an example. Actually, they would have said it's Grianja, right, which means the sun.
Okay, yeah.
But in English, the word Grianja or Grianja sounds like the word green. So the troopers would go, all right, that sounds like Green Hill. Write that down. Green Hill, Green Mound.
Oh, my, yeah.
So they did it based on the similar sounding. So terms like English, the Gaelic terms for fire is very similar to the English word black. Right? So when you're saying fire, or you know how you used to light a fire on the headland for ships and it's a beacon? Where the word beacon comes from an old Irish word that sounds very like the English word black. So that's why when you look on a map of Ireland and keep seeing these places, Green Hill, Green Town, Greenwich, Greenwich Village, Greenwich, London.
Yeah.
That didn't mean green something or other. It meant sun place of the sun. So the Greenwich Mean Time, where they take the sun measurements to this day, Greenwich Mean Time, is an old pagan meaning saying the place of the sun. Doesn't that make more sense to you if they're taking the time from that place than
much
Green Hill?
Oh, much more so. Green
Witch. Same thing with the word black. So when you look on a map and see Black Hill, you know, or Blackstown or whatever, there's so many in Ireland. Black Mountain, for instance, we have a place outside, directly outside Belfast called Black Mountain. That didn't mean Black Mountain. It meant the mountain where they lit the beacons, where they put the light, the mountain of light. You see, then I'm just giving you two examples, Henrik, two tiny examples.
Yeah.
The travesty that was done, the declaration of war. The translations and the mistranslations. Belfast, right? Named after Bell, is one of the ones that, you know, remains intact, where the old term Bell is still there.
Yeah, but going back to Baal, the ancient god.
That's right, like the Baltic.
Yeah, yeah.
The Baltic Ocean, yeah. But Dubbelin, the Black Pool, you know. So you've got, like, Blackpool. There's another one, Blackpool in England.
Exactly. Amazing.
I mean, there's a big difference when you're talking about the Black Lake, and Blackpool is, of course, on the coast, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And on the coast, that's where they used to light the beacons for the ships. That's where they used to have the permanent... See, the ancient Gaelic people used to worship the gods of the headland.
Mm.
The cliffs and the headlands were very important, and they were given over to certain gods and certain goddesses.
Yeah.
And especially the relationship between the land and the sea was very, very important. So they would always have perpetual fires lit.
Yeah, and speaking of, sorry to interrupt there, Michael, but speaking about Blackpool, that seems to be a tradition that they still are keeping up, because they have a festival down there called the Festival of Lights. You know, the entire city is basically the first town, I think, that was actually lit up in the way it was in regards to all the, you know, there's tremendous amounts of Ferris wheels and, you know, lights everywhere, basically, down in Blackpool.
I didn't know that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a very interesting article from Matthew Deleuze about the festivals of lights down in Blackpool. So, yeah.
I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And see, there's your whole tie-in again with the gods of the headlands and the lighting. So it would have been the light pool, or the lakes of the light, or the headland of the light.
Yeah.
You know, so again, this is a form. So and the top of the heap. You know, let's not go through the hundreds and thousands of examples. Let's just go straight to the top of the heap, the word Celtic.
Mm, yeah.
I mean, you know, I've read everything out there that's on that word. If the Romans who came up with it, Polybius and these other Romans, the information is in the book, you know, but basically they, it really was the loosest term that just meant anyone who's uncivilized living outside Rome.
Hmm. Really?
That's, you know, okay. That's basically what it meant, and they couldn't decide whether that meant the blonde, tall, Teutonic people, you see, of Germany and also of Scandinavia, or it meant the shorter, swarthier people of Spain and France, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And they never really made a distinction, because they weren't trying to make a distinction. These are colonizers who just paint the whole of their empire with the same brush.
Yeah.
Empire doesn't concern itself with what these people were. It's concerned about what they're going to be under our rule.
That's right, yeah.
Right? We're not interested in the gods you worshipped and the clothes you wore and all of that nonsense. We're interested in, are you wearing the toga the way we tell you to wear the toga? And have you got your hair cut the way we tell you to have the haircut? Yeah. And are you importing our goods like we told you to import them?
Yeah.
And have you got the temples to our gods like we told you to build?
Yeah, that's right.
And if you don't, we're going to go in there and massacre you, okay? So this is why later on, the term became more and more insubstantial.
Mm.
And so it's very important to realize that in my work, I am one of the first people to not use that term Celtic and to replace it, you know, with other terms that may make much more sense. But although there's a lot of new research out there that's also corroborating this now, that has shown that basically, even from a genetics point of view, it's very unhelpful to use the term Celtic. You know, I'm coming from the tradition of L.A. Waddell and people like Connor McDarry and Emmanuel Velikovsky and Commons Beaumont, you know, as early as the 1800s and 1920s, we're already having a problem with the term. So this is not new research that's throwing this term out. You know, my mentors, the people whose footsteps I'm following, have already shown that the term is highly spurious and was designed to lead attention away from the true names and the true words that represented the Irish people.
Yeah. And we talked about a few of the, I guess, more terms that are more appropriate, and I guess the Druids is one good word, but also the Aryans, I guess.
Yeah, and we'll have to, you know, definitely get into that depth in a future program, because that... is another key area of my work, which is the renovation of the word Aryan and what it really means. We talked a little bit about it last week, in the sense that, look, you know, an Aryan meant nothing more than a nobleman, a person of light, from a person of spiritual caliber from any culture in the world. But specifically as it relates to the Druids themselves, because to me the words are interchangeable, you know, we definitely have to get into a whole, hopefully we can do a whole show just on that.
Definitely. Sounds like
it. But, you know, let's not ever mistake the fact that we're living in a time in which these teachings, you know, all of the past are not just about the past. People have to have a very strong understanding of where they've come from.
Mm, yeah.
Because exactly the same wars of colonialization are happening now.
That's right, exactly. There is a direct, you know, line from you know, as many people would consider to be, you know, ancient history in that sense, all the way up to, you know, those who are interested in understanding the New World Order, because this connects very much with that, you know.
Well, another thing that people can look into, and it's absolutely a legitimate history for people who do have a background in Irish history, is, you know, to check out Geoffrey Keating, the writer from the 1600s,
mm-hmm.
who was one of the first accurate historians trying to preserve ancient Irish history. And he pointed out that, you see, we're all familiar with the slaughter of the Druids. We know that the Romans, you know, specifically sought out the Druids who were hiding in France, and then the last group of Druids was hiding in Wales, and we know that they were slaughtered by the Romans.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Romans kept notes. They wrote it down. They wrote down what they did.
Mm.
You know, Julius Caesar and his people, they actually kept
records,
historical notes about the slaughter that they had done.
Sure.
But that wasn't just the only slaughter. I mean, in every book you just hear only about that.
Mm-hmm.
That was just the beginning. There was a campaign all the way up to the Christian time and all the way through the Christian times of slaughter and destruction of Ireland.
Mm.
One of the most important and most significant suppressions of wholesale genocide that was done was on the Bards.
Mm-hmm.
For people who don't know what the word Bard is, B-A-R-D,
mm-hmm.
It was an Irish poet. And they were second in line to the Druidic order. They were part of the Druidic order, mm-hmm. but they were the next level down.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The Druids had, you know, a three-part, like a trinity, they had a three-part governmental system with the Druids at the top, the Bards came next, and then came the minstrels.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Bards were a very big group of people, because the Druids was a relatively small group of people. They were elite, you see. They were very, very, they were like Plato's philosopher kings.
Mm-hmm.
But the Bards made up a gigantic, you know, demographic of people who were the keepers of the records of Ireland. They were the ones who actually kept the meticulous notes pertaining to the language, the poetry. But one other thing, Henrik,
mm-hmm.
the Bards were the keepers for the kings of the kingly lineage.
Oh, really?
Yes, mm-hmm. They were what your genealogists would be today.
Yeah, okay, I see. Yeah.
But they had it all in their heads, Henrik. They didn't write it down, and they didn't have computers.
That's right.
The Bard was the expert that if some drunken king in Ireland, you know, down in the more historical ages, wanted a refresher on who his forefathers were.
Yeah.
The guy who would arrive with all the charts, you know, mostly in his head, would be the Bard, whose job it was, the Bardic order, to memorize every single dignitary or nobleman or, you know, anyone of elevated upper class status. The Bard was the one who knew that person's own lineage. The people themselves couldn't care less. They were ignorant. The Bard was the one who maintained the genealogical learning all the way back through the thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
The Roman army, and under Adrian the Fifth, Adrian, the king of England,
mm-hmm.
they wiped out the Bards to a man. A wholesale slaughter, which did what? It removed the royalty and the upper class of Ireland from their ancient Irish original roots. They lost those roots. They couldn't remember them. The knowledge was completely lost in the same way that you go and burn down a government office with all the documents in it. Mm-hmm. It's gone forever. Mm-hmm. Nobody has the information. That's exactly what happened in wholesale slaughter.
Hmm.
Now, this was not just men taking hammers to some computers or, you know, burning filing cabinets. This was people taking swords to some of the finest human beings that ever lived on the face of this earth.
Mm.
Purified, semi-enlightened beings whose minds could not only remember countless volumes of poems and songs and traditions, you see, but also knew the history of every single nobleman who lived in Ireland. There were meticulous connections to Atlantis, to Egypt, to all the other royal houses of the world at that time.
Yeah.
All of that knowledge was destroyed en masse in just a couple of years.
Wow.
And so the Irish were permanently cut off from their ancient roots. Their whole roots was taken. Now, my friend, that is exactly the same kind of thing that has been happening ever since in this world, which is why you see people so adrift in this world, because they're cut off from their lineage.
So my work is not just for the Irish people or people in the world who are interested in Irish mythology, and I think it's a great thing to be interested in that, but it's for anyone to revitalize their interest in their own culture so that they can go back and study their traditions, their past, to find out what kind of a bestial work has been done to leave the people of the world so existentially afloat.
Yeah.
It's about this modern problem that is destroying the world that my work, you see, is based on. It's not just about, continue your history lesson from the school that you went.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. I heard what you're saying. This is about finding, in a way, an identity and an understanding of again, where we're coming from and what has been going on, again, because these are important things if you want to find a center and find a good fundamental aspect of where you are, or where you're at, basically, in your life, you know?
You know, people try to make a throwback to the past in the hippie era, but it was pathetic. People try to do it in England, you know, with the sort of the hippie movement there. We go, oh, we're going to be pagan now. We're going to go back to our roots and let's wave a couple of wands around or dress up like a druid, or whatever.
Mm.
This is nonsense. These people don't know the history. They're just, it's a fashion.
Yeah, sure.
Really understanding where you came from is to discover all the layers and layers and layers of lies and sheaths that have been put on you. It's like renovating a house. You've got to take off all the wallpaper. You've got to, go down. So you discover through a process of renovation who you are under all of those colonialistic aspects.
Mm.
And this is a message that goes out to the people of Spain, of Mexico. I mean, you don't have to tell the Basque people. They're already hot at it, doing it. They're adamant about finding their roots.
Yeah.
Well, I wish everybody was as passionate.
That's right.
Yeah. And, we need to get through all of these veils of lies to discover what were we and who are we beneath the veil of all of this lacquer, all of this debris that has been put on us by the colonialists. How have our minds been colonized by these infections?
Yeah. And there are a lot of horrors, I guess, when you go through these layers. And that's what many people, I guess, in a way, turn away from, because it's too dark, maybe. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but the darkness of death and ignorance is even worse. I get an email every day going, hey, Michael, tell me more about how I'm meant to heal.
Mm.
You talked in your work about psychic hygiene. How do I heal? Well, we've just been talking about it.
Yeah.
You know, deconstruction. Healing is a process of getting back to the state that you were originally. It's about discovering who you are on a personal level, outside all the conditionings of the roles. We've talked about this in other shows, about your personal life and the role that you're playing, not being the real you.
Mm.
Well, the whole of the society, the whole of humanity is playing a role.
That's right, of course.
If you want to get rid of the United Nations and pseudo-governments like Blair and Bush and so many other people are putting up, if you want to get rid of Bilderberg societies and you want to get rid of NATO and you want to get rid of corporations and the World Bank, there's a very easy way to do it. Don't rely on them. Find out who you are culturally, community-wise, and you won't need these edifices of, empire.
Exactly, the handrails of control.
You simply will not need them, and then they'll have to pack up.
Yep.
Because remember, they can't fight all the people all the time. They don't do that in today's life anymore. They do it in a much more subtle way.
Yeah. And people also only accept these institutions, or they turn to this form of security or even surveillance or whatever because of their sense of, insecurity in the world.
And because of the rape that's been done to them. So
people
should not be blaming themselves. People should not be in any form of pessimism. People should just realize that a new set of tools have been given to you now in this age to deal with the hidden hand.
Mm.
You didn't have these tools before. It's like trying to club a whale with a matchstick. Right? It's not going to happen. But now you've been given the right tools for the right job.
Mm.
You've been given the right instruments to see the enemy correctly. You see, before the enemy was an indistinct shadow. Before the enemy was a tiger in the long grass.
Yeah.
Now you've been given the opportunity to burn down the camouflage so you can see the beast, and then you go, oh, this is not a problem. I can shoot that thing right through the head.
Yeah, that's right.
Because it's only the fear, it's only the great shadows, like the Wizard of Oz, it's like the great shadows that this tiny little nothing beast has been scaring everybody with.
Yeah.
You are in the age now to carry high the torch and to burn down the camouflage so that you see the skulking, pathetic, sick, toxic creature that is, the predator that has been preying on the whole human race. And once you see pathetic thing that this is, and discover your own power again, then you can dust it off your shoulder like just so much dust.
Mm.
and get out of the fear mode, you see, that has been paralyzing the human race.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And
history is not key to this. What is key to this is the manipulation of history, the study of the manipulation of your history, because history is you. When you study history, you're studying yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Mankind is studying himself through the subject of history. And when you find out who's been manipulating that subject so you don't have a clear picture of yourself, then you can do something about it, and then the healing of the world begins.
That's right. That's definitely right, you know. Yeah, I think, Michael, that's a great way to round things off for this time. I want to thank you so much again for an awesome show here. And
always a pleasure, man.
Before we leave, I always want to leave the last few minutes with you, leaving your the website address that you want to give out any information that you have, either regarding DVDs or books or whatever, Michael.
Well, the book is still, you know, underway. It's out of my hands right now. It's in the editing phase, so people know as much about it as I do right now, but they can see the excerpts. Just go to IrishOriginsOfCivilization.com or go to MichaelTessarian.com and click on through to the Irish Origins site. And the excerpts of the book is there, and these appendices are there. So I really want people to go in and look at the appendices section, because there's a section there called the Minoan Civilization.
Mm-hmm.
And it deals with the Minoans and the Templars, and this whole thing about the salt lines and the geometric grids that were all over the earth in ancient times.
Yeah.
Again, it'll be like people discovering, like I did back in 1985, just how much wisdom and incredible stellar knowledge was, you know, in the keeping of these ancient Irish. People need to become, you know, aware of this. Go to that appendices section on the Minoan civilization of Crete.
Yeah.
And you're going to read amazing things there. You know, in the meantime, there's a lot of things there to keep people busy until the book is completed. You know, and that section is updated repeatedly. So again, IrishOriginsOfCivilization.com, or just go to my site, MichaelTessarian.com, and you'll see the direct links taking into that site.
Wonderful. Yeah, and definitely check out that appendices section. That's wonderful, and it's growing, as you say, all the time. So that's great. Again, that's MichaelTessarian.com or IrishOriginsOfCivilizations.com. But again, until next time, Michael, looking forward to speaking to you again. It's always a pleasure to have you on. Looking forward to next time.
Thank you very much.
This is Red Ice Creations Radio. Thank you for tuning in, and also thanks for all the kind and supportive mail and email that we get. The suggestions and other feedback we get is also very appreciated. Thanks to producer Fredrik Palmgren. We will be back on Sunday. Until then, I want you to take good care. And in the meantime, you know where to go, redicecreations.com. This is Henrik Palmgren signing off.
One day as I was walking, and walking all alone, I heard a young couple making their moan. Said the older one to the fonder one, "Bonnie lass, I must away, for the king he has commanded us, and his orders I must obey."
Oh, first thou are your promises, when first you won my love, to keep me on me take, do not me forsake, for great is my love. Through France and Spain, Bonnie Ireland, along with you I'll go.
Journey, bitter cold and burning heat, rough roads and stony mountains, they will wound your tender feet, and to your kinsmen too, you will prove untrue. if from them you go. For maids must bide at their parents' side, while men do fight the foe.
I fear no parents' anger, nor any daring foe, since I have resolved along with you to go.
And his orders I must obey.